Bill Prendergast. Mr Quinn said he fundamentally disagreed with Ms Prendergast and described Mr Gilmore as a spectacular leader who would lead the party into the next general election. Earlier, Mr Gilmore said he had no intention of stepping down. Northern Ireland's Fire and Rescue Service has said that a farm blaze that killed over 4,000 pigs in County Armagh was accidental. The fire service had said that the blaze in Bessbrook on Saturday morning may have been started deliberately. However, tonight, a spokesman said the fire was now being treated as accidental and investigations were continuing to identify the source. The singer Paul Simon and his wife Edie Brickell have been arrested and charged in the United States with disorderly conduct after what police say was a domestic violence incident. Officers say they were called to the couple's home in Connecticut on Saturday night. They said there had been, as they put it, aggressiveness on both sides. The weather forecast: dry tonight with mist and possibly dense fog developing over southern parts. Lowest temperatures 3 to 7 degrees. Warm and dry in most parts tomorrow with sunny spells. And that's all for now. News again here on Radio 1 at 11.
Now on RT Radio 1, Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods.
On the programme, Peggy Seeger, A Life in Music and Song.
A little girl, I wished I was a boy. I tagged along behind the gang and wore me corduroys. Everybody said I only did it to annoy, but I was gonna be an engineer.
Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. Peggy Seeger is one of the outstanding figures in world folk music, a singer who carries a wealth of tradition and who has helped to both renew and challenge that tradition. An outstanding musician who makes string and ivory sound out clear and true, and a songwriter who has written and writes memorable songs of love, hope and political passion. From a unique musical family, her mother a noted composer, her father a musicologist, the Seeger name became synonymous with music and political activism. She's one of the few people who can pay witness to the work of Leadbelly, Paul Robeson, Woody Guthrie and other great figures of music and song and protest in America and around the world. I'd seen Peggy Seeger in concert many times and spoke to her briefly on this programme some months ago after the death of her brother Pete Seeger. Her own story is rich and remarkable, effectively exiled from the US in the mid-1950s as a result of her defiance on a ban to travel to communist China, settling in England and making a life, a family and a seam of song with Ewan McCall and inspiring his great song, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. After his death in 1989, she continued to write, sing and perform. And in 2006, she and her partner, Irene Piper Scott, united in a civil partnership. I met Peggy Seeger recently at her home in Oxford and we spoke of many things, beginning with her earliest memories of hearing and making music and song.
My mother used to transcribe songs from huge aluminium records that had been taken from the Library of Congress. I always need to go back when someone asks a question. The 1930s were a time when President Roosevelt instigated the Works Progress Administration, and it involved people like the Lomaxes going out and collecting. So they'd bring what they collected back to the Library of Congress. And we lived in Washington, D.C., so my mother started working with the Lomaxes, and she would get these huge, I mean, they were 16 inches. They were played with thorn needles that you had to sharpen on something that looked like a sandpaper sparkler. It was different times back then. It's a very strange thing to think of how many ways that we had of transcribing and of photocopying and da-da-da way back then. So she would play these while she was transcribing them, and we'd learn them line by line, literally line by line. It was very upsetting, you know, while you were waiting for the next line. And you'd hear the line that you'd just learned probably 50 times. So I learned songs from very, very young. I osmosed them. Now I have trouble osmosing songs. I more or less learn them from print, which is a sad loss when you think of it.
Your mother, of course, is also a great composer of music. And a remarkable woman, clearly a remarkable woman. Did you kind of, again, absorb a lot of that music from her and that instinct towards making music from her? I came across a reference to you playing the Irish washerwoman in a particular key. Was it at the age of 10?
Oh, yeah. Well, my mother taught me piano. I wasn't aware of her fantastic compositions till I was in my 30s. It wasn't talked about in our house. What was talked about was folk music. She was wonderful at improvising on the piano. She taught me piano from the time I was 6. She didn't teach me with the usual running up and down scales and arpeggios and things like that. She just taught me to love playing. She taught me the circle of fifths so that I could play. I could understand the relationship of the chords in almost any key. So the Irish washerwoman was our was cannon fodder for us. And she taught me to play it in all the keys that there are on the piano, pretty much by the time I was 10 or 12. Yeah. She died when I was 18, and I became aware of what she had composed in the 30s when the women's movement got hold of her. And when I first heard those strange, dissonant pieces, I thought, this isn't my mother. This isn't the one that I knew. The one that I knew did folk music and played glorious piano, absolutely wonderful piano. She played nearly every night until I was about 10, 11, 12.
Let's hear some of that music. This is an extract from Ruth Crawford Seeger's String Quartet 1931, played by the Pellegrini Quartet. Peggy often talks about her mother during live concerts, including this concert recorded in New Zealand.
I was talking to you about my mother earlier on. Her name was Ruth Crawford Seeger, and she was an extraordinary woman. She's now regarded as one of the main composers of modernist music of the 1900s. I lost her when she was 53 and I was 18, and I recently have missed her more than I can say. My mother is younger than me. She died at 53 with plump red cheeks and black braids. My hair is gray now. My cheeks are lined. She sits at my knee, her head inclined to accept my care. I comb and braid her hair as she once did mine. And as I sing, she tells me things about her new school. As I grew my wings, she opened the window, and out she flew. I am 75. She is 53. Strange. My mother is younger than me.
The rich music legacy from her mother inspired Peggy Seeger from a very early age.
So the idea of composing songs myself, I made up my first tune when I was about, when I learned sixths on the piano, I remember, and I was fascinated by the idea of playing sixths, the interval of sixths, and I made up a tune that the family went crazy because I just wouldn't stop playing it. And then when I was 75, I made up words for it. So I was co-writing with myself, my older person and my younger person.
So and I think that song is on your forthcoming album, new album.
Forthcoming album, yes it is. And I'm very pleased with it because it is such a strange, rogue little piece. Everybody who hears it loves it. And yet it literally took no time to make the words. Well, the words are very repetitive, like a lot of pop tunes are these days. But it's the tune I made when I was 8 and the words I made when I was 74.
Nero's children play with matches. Noah's children cannot swim. Adam's children kill each other and sing of love and money. Tune the fiddle, build the ark, dance in the dark. Ashes to dust, in God we trust and dream of love and money. Split the sky, trample flowers, set the ice on fire. Home was built in a year, burnt in an hour, all for love of money. The baby's crying, mother's dying behind the bedroom door. Strike the match, light the candle, head for land and swim. Save each other, save your mother, and sing of love, of love. Sing of milk and honey.
Nero's Children there from Peggy Seeger's forthcoming album Everything Changes. I also asked Peggy about the title track of that album. Was Everything Changes about her mother's death?
It's not about my mother's death, literally. When I hit about 68, 69, it would have been about 10 years ago, I began to viscerally miss her. To actually have a physical longing to have her alive again. I lost her when I was 18. I'd been a horrible teenager. I was sent away to school 1 year. And she died before we got together. She would have been totally and utterly fascinated by my life. And she would have entered in on it. Because she gave me such a good classical education, I employ a lot of classical ideas. It's widened my ability of what I can actually write. I mean, I don't know if you've heard things like the plutonium factor, and you've heard things like RSI, some of my more out songs. And I don't know why all of a sudden at 19, you know, when I was 68, 69, I began to miss her.
What age was she when she died? She was 53.
And she was just beginning to write again. So I didn't write the song then. I got the idea for it when I was sitting on my back porch in Boston with Susan Forbes Hansen, who's a DJ in the United States, in Boston. And she was talking about the house that she'd lived in when she was young. And she went back to see it 40 years later and was horrified by what had disappeared. And she talked about it. And I put my feelings about my mother's death into this because I'm talking about what the neighborhood was like when I was a child, how we went out to play, and how we were part of a little group of siblings. And It was a Washington suburb, and you could go out in the dark as children and play hide and seek for as much as a block away from your house in other people's backyards. You can't do that now, you know. And my mother would ring the bell, and you'd hear it, and she'd call. and we would come home. You don't do that now. Children don't do that now. As I put in the song, with children, their world's on a screen, and they play games alone with themselves on these screens.
The town I lived in when I was young, everybody knew my name, the world was my own, safe in the dark, playing games, till Mama called me home. But that was then, now it's now, everything changes somehow. The house I lived in, the town I lived in, everything changes, everything.
Changes, the title of the song, and of course everything in life, everything does change.
Nothing is constant but change, remember?
Yes, indeed.
Is that Marxist or is it what? Nothing is constant but change.
Well, I think it's also a great truth of life and humanity, but change can also be a really good thing, and change and development through life. And I mean, as you said, you've seen so much from the 1930s growing up, you know, there's to now, so much change, and some things getting better, some things maybe staying constantly not so good. And I'm thinking about some of the songs you wrote with Ewan McCall, those kind of great songs of political anger in the 70s, you know, Blast Against Blackguards. And
you have done your homework.
Well, I heard you play in Liberty Hall, you know, and several times, and those were remarkable albums. And just thinking about the kind of the articulate anger about what was happening in Britain. I mean, going back to the radio ballads as well, and, you know, the Go Move Shift and some of those great songs, but then those later songs as well, Legal, Illegal, and they were terrific. They really put their finger on something. And I wonder how did you work together, yourself and Ewan, in making songs together?
Well, we didn't work together. That's the answer. The ones you've mentioned are his songs. He was more direct. My songs tended to come at things kind of crabwise, sideways, because he was brought up with very, very basic political anger, outrage, fury. And I was brought up with what we call progressive thinking in the United States, which was middle class, theoretical. I mean, we never went hungry. We didn't have an orange crate by the side of our bed as its table. If I was instructed to bring an orange to school to draw, I would take an orange. Ewan didn't have an orange. He took an onion. I don't know if you've read his autobiography, and the embarrassment, the shame, he had that in him. But we didn't write songs together. We talked about making songs, and then one of us would go off, and sometimes we'd both go off and deal with the same subject, and then we'd bring what we thought was the finished one to each other. And I will say that generally his songs were more finished when he brought them to me. He brought them to me to accompany them, to put them into with an instrument. I'm not fearfully well educated politically, and I read quite widely, but I remember very little. And that's sad, but all I want to remember now is my songs. And I'm in the middle of writing a memoir, and I'm having to ask my children, what happened in the 1960s? What happened in the 1960s?
What was I doing that year?
What was I doing, and I have to look at my songs to remind myself what we were doing. You know, I've just written up the 1980s, and I forgot to mention that I was arrested and that I made a song to sing to the judge. I haven't put it in.
Why were you arrested at that time?
I was objecting to cruise missiles, part of the Greenham Common thing. And it was quite dramatic. I know, it's quite dramatic.
One thing, again, when you say what you particularly want to remember is the songs, but one thing I wonder if you remember, a documentary that you worked on with you, and a TV documentary for the BBC, in 1966, called The Irishmen.
Oh, yes, right.
About the men who worked on the building Victoria Tunnel. Line.
Yeah. On the Victoria Line.
Tell me about making that and what happened with it.
Oh, my. Well, Ewan made the songs, and he made them all out of Irish tunes. Some wonderful ones, absolutely wonderful. And the Tunnel Tigers is brilliant. He went down below to talk to the men. I didn't. And I don't know quite why. Maybe the budget didn't go for that. Because when we did the radio ballads, the BBC paid for both of us to go and record the people that the programme was about. And it's something that we always stressed, that if you're going to write a song about something you know nothing about, you go and talk personally to the people, because you will get something from them that you just cannot get from just a recording. It's like we're recording now. Maybe people think in their minds what I look like, what it's all happening, but you will get more from this probably than they will. This doesn't mean they won't get something. I hope they will get something from it. But just seeing the way the person is, how they handle themselves and how articulate. And this is what really hit me so much. So many people who talk about themselves, it's like, oh, you know, I'm like, oh, well, like I did that. What did I do? Oh, well, they didn't do that. They had concise and totally involved, because you were interested in their work and the effect that their work had on them. So The Irishman, it was a bit of a hoot, because I think Martin Byrne played in that. The fiddle. Oh, who were the players? And I think Dominic Behan sang something in that. He was so strange to work with. I think we had Frank Hart on it, did we? I can't remember. I remember the actual recording sessions, because union rules said that you were supposed to stop working after about an hour and a half, and the players wouldn't stop. They just kept on going. But I don't think it was ever broadcast. And has it still not been broadcast?
I have a feeling not.
Because it was a wonderful show. Absolutely wonderful. I mean, there's photographs now of, I think there's a new tunnel being driven through London. And have you seen the picture of the machine that's... I mean, you have to use a microscope to see the person that's down at the bottom of the picture.
The Tunnel Tiger's a great song.
Oh, it is.
Remarkable song. You're listening to Arts Tonight. My guest is Peggy Seeger. More in a moment, including her memories of how she inspired one of the greatest love songs ever written.
RTE Radio 1. It all began on Friday night. Father and I were eating lamb and bitter greens in the kitchen. Lamb and bitter greens are necessary things. Our lives are full of necessary things because we are living in the last days.
This week's Book on One is The Land of Decoration by Grace MacLean.
We read the Bible every day, and then we ponder what we have read. Reading the Bible and pondering are also necessary things.
Judith lives with her father, a devoutly religious man mourning for his wife, the mother Judith never knew. At home in her room, Judith finds comfort in creating a miniature world, which she calls the Land of Decoration.
When I close the door of my room, the walls fold back, and there are planets and rainbows and suns.
And from there, she wills miracles to happen. But when they do, they bring trouble with them. The Land of Decoration by Grace MacLean is the Book on One tonight at 10 past 11 on RTE Radio 1.
first time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your eyes, and the moon and stars were the gift you gave. Dark and empty skies, my love.
Of course, you inspired one of the great love songs.
Your face,
exactly. The first time ever I saw your face, wonderful song, and it's a great thing to have done that, to have been the inspiration for such a song. I just wonder, when you met Ewan, when you saw him, did you see something? Because one often does in a face. Did you see something in him that drew you to him?
No. I was terrified by him. I mean, he was a married man and he was 20 years older than me. And he had a child. And he was voraciously in love. I was rather frightened by him and intrigued and fascinated, because he was the most interesting person other than Pete that I had ever met. I mean, I'd been courted by boys up till then. And there was this man who, the first time he takes you home from, he invited me to come see the play that he was in. He was in the Threepenny Opera. And he brought me home in his old Vauxhall Standard. And he put his arm around my shoulder and he said, "I'm going to make love to you." I didn't even know what the phrase meant, you know. I mean, the boys that I was with didn't talk about screwing and fucking, but they didn't make quiet declarations. And my heart just fluttered, you know. And being involved with a married man, that wasn't in my idea of what I was going to do with my life. No, I thought he was very odd.
The first time ever I lay with you, and felt your heart beat next to mine, I thought our joy
yourself were on stage in the last couple of years in that wonderful tribute concert to Kate McGarrigle and sing Tell My Sister, this beautiful version of her song Tell My Sister. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's marvellous.
I had not really appreciated what a good songwriter she is, you know, because one of the problems with writing a lot of songs yourself is that you don't have space on the programme to sing other people's songs. I am singing more of other people's songs now. I'm trying to get out of the box, but it's very hard. The instrument I'm most free on is the piano. I really love, and my piano playing is very basic. It can be quite inventive, but it generally sticks to the European chord systems, which many people just find comfort in. I'm not very innovative on the piano. I used to be a good piano player. I actually got up to 4 or 5 hours practicing a day, but I didn't have the nerve. You know, it's like Kirsty, Ewan's oldest daughter, who wrote some wonderful songs, but she was frozen on stage. Well, that's what happened to me with classical music, and I just couldn't do it.
She was a great singer. She was,
yes.
But tell my sister to tell my mother I'm coming home.
alone. And when my blues are gone and once again I'm gay, I'm gonna hop that old jetliner, I'm gonna sail away. But tell my sister to tell my mother I'm coming home alone.
I want to ask you about two people. And I think one of them you knew a little and the other maybe a little better. Brendan Behan and Jean Ritchie. They seem like an unlikely duo in a way. But Behan, I think did you meet in New York?
I met him twice. He came to the door of the Carnegie Hall concert and had himself announced. And he was rolling drunk. And Ewan gave instructions for him not to be let in. And he battered at the door, and he battered at the door. And they finally let him in and let him sit in the back of the hall where he barracked us. And we saw him afterward. He's not somebody I kind of felt a close sympathique with him. And he paid very little attention to me. He mostly was, you know, talking with Ewan, because Ewan was good with that, you know. Dominic was the one I knew more because he was a member of the Singers Club for a while. But I wouldn't say I knew Brendan Behan. I sat across a table just with my eyes popping out. You know, that would have been, 1960, somewhere way, way back. When did he die?
He died in 64, just 64, 50 years this year since he died. So he was in a sense at the height and at the height of the low as well at that point. But Jean Ritchie, the great singer who came to Ireland on a Fulbright, I think again in the late 50s or maybe 1960, and did wonderful work in a recording and is a great singer.
I saw her first on stage when I would have been about 16, 17. And I wanted to sing like that. But she sings a couple of octaves above where I can get. And she had that pure silver voice. Mine is nothing like that at all. And I also saw her with her first child. I remember being entranced by her sitting by the side of the bed with her face just looking at this little baby. That was in New York. That probably would have been in 60 or 61. Then I saw her at Rosalie Sorrell's concert in Boston. When Rosalie Sorrell's, I think she had a 70th birthday there. And Jean did a wonderful job, absolutely wonderful. And she came dressed in kind of an American peasant. I'm afraid, dressed like a diva, with a float dress, and she just loved the float dress. And so I told her exactly where she could get one and arranged that they would send her one, and she adored it because I wanted her to have, you know, getting out of your box. I mean, I used to sit on the stages in my dirndls and my saddle shoes and my white socks. And I began to dress a little bit better when we started to do more concerts. I actually began to dress quite sexy. I remember giving concerts in miniskirts, and that's difficult, very difficult, especially if you play the banjo and you're supposed to have your legs parted. So, and Jean, she's always been so gracious. Visited her at her house about 10 years ago. And her son Peter, who worked with in music sales, was responsible for music sales publishing Ewan's and my songbooks, which I think you probably have. I mean, he had to battle the music sales people who said, these won't sell enough. And they were right, you know. We never were high sales.
Every time you pick up a newspaper, every time you switch on the TV, you can bet your old boots that at some point you'll see a high-ranking copper or Tory MP calling on all who are British and free to stand up and defend law and order. It's illegal to rip off a payroll. It's illegal to hold up a train. But it's legal to rip off a million or two that comes from the labor that other folk do. To plunder the many on behalf of the few is a thing that is perfectly legal. It's illegal to kill off a landlord or to trespass upon his estate. But to charge a high rent for a slum is okay. To condemn two adults and three children to stay in a hovel that's rotten with damp and decay is a thing that is perfectly legal. If your job turns you into a zombie, it's legal to feel some despair. But don't be aggressive, that is, if you're smart, and for Christ's sake, don't upset the old apple cart. Remember, the boss has your interests at heart, and it grieves him to see you unhappy. If you fashion a bomb in the kitchen, you're guilty of breaking the law. But a bloody great nuclear plant is okay, though plutonium processing hastens the day when this tight little isle may be blasted away. Nonetheless, it is perfectly legal. It's illegal if you are a gypsy to camp by the side of the road. But it's proper and right for the rich and the great to live in a mansion and own an estate that was got from the people by pillage and rape. That's what they call a tradition. It's illegal to carve up your missus
or put poison in your old man's tea.
But poison the rivers, the seas and the skies, and poison the mind of the nation with lies. If it's done in the interests of free enterprise, then it's proper and perfectly legal. It's legal to join a trade union, and to picket is one of your rights. But don't be offensive when scabs cross the line. Be nice to the coppers and keep this in mind. To picket effectively, that is a crime. Worse than if you had murdered your mother. It's legal to sing on the telly, but they make bloody sure that you don't. If you sing about racists and fascists and creeps and thieves in high places who live off the weak and those who are selling us right up the creek, the twisters, the takers, the con men, the fakers, the whole bloody gang of exploiters.
Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger there with Legal Illegal. Speaking to Peggy Seeger, I asked her about the honorary doctorate she was awarded recently from Salford University, an apt and appropriate award from a place for which she has a deep affection.
First time I saw Salford was in 1956. Ewan took me up there to see where he was brought up. And it's the first time I'd ever seen anything like that. And it hadn't been redeveloped at that point. He showed me the Irwell, the mucky canal where he'd nearly drowned. I was very honoured by the Doctorate of Arts because people always said Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger. And if we were here talking now and you'd come to record us, if you were like the rest of them that came, you'd record him first. They always recorded him first. And no wonder, he was totally articulate. Completely articulate, like Pete. Pete could just, you know, he'd talk until you stopped him. And then after an hour of talking to you, and they'd turn to me and say, what do you think? Well, it's all been said, because Ewan and I talked a lot. I started talking after Ewan died. virtually. It wasn't that he hogged it. It's that both of us knew he was better at it. He was better at it. He had the theatre training, and he'd been interviewing since he was probably 20, 22, 23 when he was working on the BBC. So being recognised by Salford University, it was due to a man named Adrian Graves, and I'm very grateful for that, because now when I really want to get some attention when I'm talking to whoever on the phone, I say, this is Dr. Peggy Seeger. I would like, and they, oh yes, Dr. Seeger, now, da, 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 and Dr. Seeger, da, Dr. Seeger, whereas if you're just Ms., you're just Peggy, you know? So I use it sometimes, you know? But I was very honoured. But it's a very strange thing, you know, Vincent, to, when the time came for me to actually accept it, I'm standing there on the sitting there on the stage with the rest of the people who are receiving their doctorates, and I'm about to give my little 5-minute speech. And all the students who have worked so hard are coming up one by one to get their degrees. You've, in a way, you feel shamed that you haven't gone through what they must have gone through with all those exams, unless you call standing up on a stage when you're utterly terrified an exam, or finding that you've had a coughing fit like I did at the awards. I'd had a coughing fit just before I went on there this last, you know, the Folk Awards, and I came on with practically no voice.
We know it's darkest before the dawn. Now you, we know it's darkest before the dawn. The coming light keeps us moving on. The coming light keeps us moving on. We must heed the early warnings. We must heed the early warnings. The time is now, quite early morning. The time is now, quite early morning.
Peggy Seeger there, leading an audience at the British Folk Awards, paying tribute to Pete Seeger. One of her own most famous songs is The Ballad of Spring Hill, recorded by many people, including Lou Kelly and the Dubliners.
In the town of Spring Hill, Nova Scotia, down in the dark of the Cumberland mine, there's blood on the coal and the miners lie. In roads that never saw sun nor sky, roads that never saw sun nor sky. Listen for the shouts of the black-faced miners. Listen through the rubble for the rescue teams. 300 tons of coal and slag, hope imprisoned in a 3-foot seam. Hope imprisoned in a 3-foot seam. Twelve days passed and some were rescued, leaving the dead to lie alone. Through all their days they dug a grave. 2 miles of earth is a marking stone. 2 miles of earth is a marking stone.
It's a great song, too.
Yes, it is. And it's a strange thing. It's not the first song I wrote. The first couple of songs that I wrote, I put in my songbook for cannon fodder for people to work on and figure out how these could have been much better or less, you know, crappy. But the Ballad of Spring Hill is a strange thing because it it was written kind of in the folk idiom. I knew so many folk songs that when I decided to write a song about that, it kind of turned out like a folk song. Yeah. It's the one song I've written that I think will probably go into the folk canon. People will sing it and they won't know who wrote it, and that is just wonderful, as long as I get the royalties.
Do you get many people asking you now to sing, "I'm going to be an engineer"?
Oh, yes. Occasionally you get a hall full of women and you wouldn't get out there alive if you didn't sing it. Yeah, but I do have to say that I never wanted to be an engineer. It just sings nicely. And
it's a great rhythm. It's wonderful.
Ewan asked me to write a song about women for one of the Festival of Fools. And if you want to find out about the Festival of Fools, just Google it. And it happened to be the year of the women. And I was sitting downstairs doing something else, and he says, "We need a song about women." And then he went upstairs to finish writing the script that he was working on. And it just flowed out. Now, isn't that strange? But it did have a very down last verse when I took it up to Ewan to sing it. He said, "No, the last verse, no." You know, sometimes political songs have a rather trite cliche at the end saying, "This is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. Oh, but all we have to do is march, you know, and the working class is going to come ahead, we'll do it." And I had decided to be realistic in my last verse. And he said, "You need to, you don't want people to leave wanting to slit their throats." You know, so I went downstairs and made it a bit more hopeful.
I think most of musicians I know have what we call an albatross, and this is my albatross. I wrote it years and years ago, and now people want me to sing it over and over again, and so I do it. It hangs around my neck, and thank goodness it's not stinking yet. It's got lots of words. It's called "I'm Gonna Be an Engineer." When I was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. It's gonna be too high. When I was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. I tagged along behind a gang of wore my corduroys. Everybody said, "Oh, they did it to annoy," but I was gonna be an engineer. Mama told me, "Can't you be a lady? Your duty is to make me the mother of a pearl. Wait until you're older, dear, and maybe you'll be glad that you're a girl. Dainty as a Dresden statue, gentle as a Jersey cow, smooth as silk gives creamy milk. Learn to coo, learn to moo. That's what you do to be a lady now." Well, when I went to school, I learned to write and how to read some history, geography, and home economy. And typing is a skill that every girl is sure to need to while away the extra time until the time to breed. Then they had the nerve to say, "What would you like to be?" I says, "I'm gonna be an engineer." "No, you only need to learn to be a lady. The duty isn't yours for to try and run the world. An engineer could never have a baby. Remember, dear, that you're a girl. She's smart for a woman. I wonder how she got that way. You get no choice, you get no voice. Just stay mum, pretend you're dumb. And that's how you come to be a lady today." Then Jimmy come along and we set up a conjugation. We were busy every night with love and recreation. I spent the day at work so he could get his education. Well, now he's an engineer. He says, "I know you'll always be a lady. It's the duty of my darling to love me all her life. Could an engineer look after or obey me? Remember, dear, that you're my wife." Well, as soon as Jimmy got a job, I began again. Then happy at my turret lay the year or so. And then the morning that the twins were born, Jimmy says to them, "Kids, your mother was an engineer. You owe it to the kids to be a lady. Dainty as a dish rag, faithful as a chow. Stay at home, you got to mind the babies. Remember, you're a mother now." Well,
Well, every time I turn around, there's something else to do. Cook a meal, mend the socks, sweep a floor or two. Holding up the potty when the baby wants to poo. I was gonna be an engineer. You know, I really wish that I could be a lady. I could do the lovely things that a lady's supposed to do. I wouldn't even mind if only they would pay me. And I could be a person too. What price for a woman? You buy her for a ring of gold. To love and obey without any pay. You get your cook and your nurse, for better or worse. You don't need your purse when the lady is sold. Ah, but now the times are harder and me Jimmy's got the sack. I went down to Vickers, they were glad to have me back. But I'm a third-class citizen, my wages tell me that. And I'm a first-class engineer. The boss, he says, we pay you as a lady. You know you only got the job, cause I can't afford a man. With you, I keep the profits high as may be. You're just a cheaper pair of hands. You got one fault, you're a woman. You're not worth the equal pay. A bitch, you're tart, you're nothing but heart. Shallow and vain, you got no brain. You even go down the drain like a lady today. Well, I listened to my mother and I joined a typing pool. I listened to my lover and I put him through his school. But if I listen to the boss, I'm just a bloody fool and an underpaid engineer. I've been a sucker ever since I was a baby. As a daughter, as a wife, as a mother and a dear. But I fight them as a woman, not a lady. Fight them as an engineer.
Peggy Seeger's new album, Everything Changes, is due out in September. It's well worth checking out her website as well, peggyseeger.com. All kinds of riches there, a small history of folk music, many insights into politics and society, and some great photos. I took away many special memories from that afternoon with Peggy Seeger, a travelling case of beautiful instruments, including a banjo made with wood from a munitions box from the American Civil War, and the verve and delight of a piano playing the warmth and welcome shown to us. And most of all, the remarkable spirit of the woman herself, a gypsy, she said, happiest when she's on the road, singing out, immersed in music, drawing others in to the power of song. We leave you with the title track from that new album, Everything Changes. Till next Monday at 10, good night.
The house I lived in when I was a child had woods. We all ran wild. You could hide, then come home after a while. The town I lived in when I was young, everybody knew my name, the world was my own. Safe in the dark, playing games, till Mama called me home. But that was then, now it's now, everything changes. Somehow, the house I lived in, the town I lived in, everything changes, everything. House I live in my hometown, the trees, the city cut them down, it's all changed, you can't hide. The house stands here, lonely and strange. I sit and cry, the children. Again.
things alone. Oh, was it a dream when Mama called me home? But that was then, now it's now. Everything changes somehow.